Okay, good afternoon or good evening, wherever you be in the world. This is the Ralph Winter Road Show, coming to you live out of Alaska. Beautiful day in Alaska. Nice and sunny. The leaves are starting to turn 57 degrees. And I am really glad, very honored today to have two guests on, Dr. Judy Wood and Andrew Johnson. We're going to be talking about 911. They are. And giving evidence. I'm going to give their bios here, but the first thing, anybody, there'll be no callers during the first hour. And the second hour is, if you have read Dr. Judy Wood's book, I highly recommend you to call in. If you are otherwise, why, the Republic Broadcasting will be screening your call, because we want to try to get the most evidence out to everyone and make the most sense of the 86 minutes or whatever I'm given here on Republic Broadcasting. Dr. Judy Wood is a former professor of mechanical engineering, and she had research interest in experimental stress analysis, structural mechanics, optical methods, deformation analysis. She carries a B.S. in civil engineering, a master M.S. in electrical or engineering mechanics, applied physics, and she has a Ph.D. in materials engineering science. And I want to welcome you. Are you there, Dr. Judy Wood?
Yes, hello. I'm here.
Great. And then we have Andrew Johnson out of the UK. And he has been assisting Dr. Judy Wood. He is has a engineering degree in computer science, and he's been in this fight. And he has a book out also on his homepage, which we'll get to a little later, that complements Dr. Judy Wood's book. Are you there, Andrew?
I'm here.
Okay, well, we go to break, and we'll get back, and we're going to get to it. Hang on. Okay, well, we're back from break here, and we've got Dr. Judy Wood from North Carolina or South Carolina, one of those places back there on the East Coast anyway, where Irene sort of went by, and Andrew Johnson from the U.K. And Dr. Judy Wood, why don't you lead this off, and let's get to some sounding evidence here of what really happened at 911.
Well, contrary to what most folks think, they're told a collapse, or they think a collapse. The towers, didn't burn up either. They didn't burn up, and they didn't slam down. They turned into dust in midair. But how do we know this? Well, if they slammed to the ground, you'd have a pile of rubble that would be relative to the size of a couple of 110-story buildings, a 47-story building, a 22-story building, and a half of a few other buildings as well. It wasn't there. Not enough rubble was there for that. Also, if it slammed to the ground, Manhattan would have been flooded, because the towers are built on bedrock that is about 70 feet below the water table. They're built out in the Hudson River with this dike around the base called a bathtub. And if those towers had fallen down, they would have ruptured the bathtub, and you would have had southern Manhattan flooded. Through the PATH train tunnels, through the subway tunnels, and so forth. Also, if they'd slammed to the ground would have shaken with a big thud, and it would have been recorded on the seismic charts. About a 20-story building or a 16-story building crashing to the ground is what the seismic chart recorded for the two towers, not a 110-story building. And for Building 7... there really was no seismic event, significant seismic event, outside of background noise. But on the same chart, you could see quarry blasts in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey. So we know the seismic recorder was working, was operational. But there really wasn't a seismic event associated with the demise of Building 7. So it didn't slam to the ground either. So the buildings didn't burn up or slam to the ground. They turned into dust in midair. And dust doesn't make a thud when it hits. Also, if they had slammed to the ground, the stuff in the building needs to go somewhere. Imagine this: if it collapsed down like a pancake, it's going to squirt stuff at it like Mach 1 or Mach 2. Like close to 2,000 miles an hour, it would be squirting stuff out. And it would look like a machine gun had blasted the side of all the buildings surrounding the World Trade Center. That didn't happen. But what we do find is, you know, a few stab wounds here and there, a few beams that went through, jabbed into buildings, but not really above the 18th floor. Nothing way high up. And the adjacent buildings were as high as 60 stories tall. But what we did find is round holes in the windows, sometimes just in the outer pane of a double-pane window, leaving the inner pane intact. Cars went into spontaneous combustion up to a half a mile away. Dust went up when the towers were destroyed, blocking out 100% of the sunlight for a period of time. Some cars were turned upside down. There's evidence of levitation. The leaves stayed on the trees. Signposts didn't get destroyed, but the cars in the street were toasted. Toasted as in they're toast, their history. You can't repair them. They're done for. And there's a sea of paper around that didn't burn. No evidence of high heat. When the dust cloud rolled out, it left people covered with dust, not burned. I can't hear.
Hold on a minute here. We are getting some noise here from Republic. Just a minute here from the...
Okay. Yeah, so I think all those things really indicate that something very strange happened, and that's essentially what you can prove from looking at the evidence.
Well, I don't want to leave out Alaska. Alaska was part of this too, right?
Oh, yeah. So some of the oddities were even recorded in Alaska, that the Earth's magnetic field coincidentally had shifts that occurred with each of the five events. You know, the North Tower got a hole in it, South Tower got a hole in it, South Tower turned into dust, North Tower turned into dust, and then 7 hours later, Building 7 turned into dust. Each of those five events, right when they occurred, there was a shift in the Earth's magnetic field. Pretty
Alaska,
strange coincidence.
Alaska's a long ways from New York, you think?
Mm-hmm. I couldn't find such wonderful data as I found in Alaska. Magnetic recording stations around the world, but the one in Alaska had the biggest data bank, and it showed this anomaly. So, may as well use that one.
So obviously, the controlled demolitions couldn't go 4,000 miles or nukes 4,000 miles away and rattle the magnetic or magnetometers in Alaska. You think?
I don't know how bombs affect magnetometers. But also, I don't know how to explain a bomb going off silently and not shaking the ground at all.
Let me ask you this. Is not seismic recordings and that type of technology, that is absolutely, positively, well-settled, grounded. There's no doubt about how seismic recordings work and what's going to happen when a certain mass at a certain velocity hit the ground. Is there any doubt in that world?
Not unless gravity gets shut off. You know,
right.
And it doesn't, and then it wouldn't hit the ground. So if something is hitting the ground, think of, on a pool table, the billiard balls hitting each other, one pops in the other one takes off. That's an impact. You know, the other one reacts to it because it's gotten hit by the first one. So if you have a building hitting bedrock, you know, it's the same kind of thing, except the bedrock isn't going anywhere. And it gets affected. It gets, you know, like a hammer hitting a tuning fork.
That
rock has got to be vibrating, and whatever seismic recording stations are picking that up, you would see it.
Let me rephrase it. In a standard controlled demolition, 230,000 tons coming out of Building 7, whether it's cut in 50 pieces or 100 pieces or 1,000 pieces, when it hits planet Earth, the technology of seismic recordings is rock solid, and more than one recording station could not find basically any recording. Is that true?
Correct. And the other ones, you have to use some imagination to see that there's any kind of very slight anomaly from background noise. It wasn't like anything you would expect. It was it's like somebody's straining to find something anomalous there. If you were just sitting in the seismic recording station, weren't looking for anything on that chart, you wouldn't have seen it.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it not true that any type of a controlled demolition, regardless of the explosive, is excluded or preclusive from ever happening because of the absence of the seismic recordings that would have absolutely been present? Is that true?
If the material slammed to the ground, you would have a seismic recording of it.
Which would happen during a controlled demolition.
Right. Because a conventional controlled demolition doesn't account for turning the building into snowflakes. Snowflakes don't slam to the ground.
And
what I'm saying, if the building did reach the ground, if you turn it into fine dust, that dust isn't going to make a thud when it hits, but conventional controlled demolitions, what they do is cut off the supports and slam the building to the ground to bust it up.
So
they don't really blow the building up in the air. They drop it down and slam it to the ground because it would take too many explosives, and that's a waste, to turn the building into chunks. And explosives turn buildings into chunks, and chunks go flying.
So because
they don't turn into powder.
So because we don't have a controlled demolition, the type of explosive, Semtex, TNT, dynamite, whatever it is automatically precluded from existing. Or thermite, whatever.
Yes. Also, the heat excludes it as well. Bombs are associated with heat. An expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a large, also the sound, something expanding quickly, you hear it. It has a sound wave. That didn't happen either.
With Building 7?
Correct.
And that's documented. So we have a quiet falling of what appears to be a controlled demolition, but it's absent the seismic recordings when it hits the ground.
Well, when it appears to reach the ground.
Right, appears to reach the ground. Okay.
Because if people didn't hear it, then you start wondering what went on here, because this is something not right. There's a video, it's quite a few video recordings of this, but one in particular I'm remembering. There's someone being interviewed with Building 7 behind them, and while they're standing there talking to the person interviewing them, the building 7 just starts moving towards the ground. And it's about halfway to the ground when the photographer says, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa." He suddenly realizes there's a building dropping behind. Nobody
okay,
was
hold
aware
that
of
thought.
It.
Girl, finish that up. We've got to go to break. Back in just a minute. Well, we're back from break, and Dr. Judy Woods was telling us about Building 7. Somebody was videotaping and the audio going, and Building 7 was starting to head to the ground. Go ahead and finish your thought there.
And it's starting to head to the ground. I think it was the photographer who noticed that and said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa." And, he had totally caught him by surprise. And the person who the building was in back of, was totally clueless. When things break, whether it's natural or with bombs or whatever, if something suddenly snaps, breaks, it's an energy release like that is associated with sound. Think of a tree falling over. You hear a snap, crackle, pop, and you get ready to hear a thud as it hits the ground when a tree breaks in the woods. Or, when you have an ice storm, you hear trees snap, snap, and you hear, bang. Sounds like almost like a gunshot. In controlled demolitions, you typically hear a bang, 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 bang for a while, and then the building starts moving towards the ground. You don't hear dead silence and have the building start moving to the ground silently. Something's weird there. And with the towers, there were small pop sounds, but there are definitely things on the ground exploding, like Scott packs, the air tanks that the firefighters wear. It makes you wonder what's going on here that would cause an air tank to explode. That's what happens when the pressure inside gets too great, the wall thickness starts to break down. And the building was filled with water tanks every so many floors because they had to pump the water up to tank after tank to get it to the top. What happens when the water tanks start getting thinner or start deteriorating. It's going to come a point when that water tank's going to explode. Any kind of pressure vessel, when it starts to come apart, will explode. Yeah, it's not like a bomb. You know, the egg in a microwave oven explodes. Doesn't mean it's an explosive. So we see these squib-looking things squirting out every so many floors at a very regular pace. It seems more likely that that's water tanks cutting loose.
Well, I thought some of the most astounding stuff, like in, I think it's chapter 9 of your book, we see the top of one of these World Trade Centers, it's tipping over, going to fall, quote, outside the footprint below, but it never makes it to the ground. It doesn't. And then we see all of these pieces of iron, this grid work, which you call what we checked, I think.
Mm-hmm. The other prefab units the building's made out of.
Yeah, they're all made out of steel. And it's looking like in midair, turning to dust. I mean, it's just they're just turning to dust. They don't make it to the ground like they're supposed to.
You see them headed towards the ground, trailing this thick, opaque dust, and then you look at the intersection right afterwards, and it's just got paper and dust in it, for the most part.
Well, tell us a comment about Stephanopoulos and that video there. I thought that was pretty astounding there.
George Stephanopoulos was at the scene, and Peter Jennings was in the studio. This is about 25 hours after the event, so it's the next day. And Peter Jennings asked George Stephanopoulos, where's all the debris? And George Stephanopoulos says, well, we've been trying to figure that out. We've been trying to ask people. And this one volunteer said it fell down to the ground, was pulverized, and then evaporated. they're struggling to explain what they see with their life's experience, and it doesn't work.
What percentage about of the 500,000 ton buildings you think made it to the ground as debris?
10% to 20%, somewhere in there. I went through some rough calculations, and if you lost the top 90 stories and were just left the bottom 20 stories for Tower 1 and just dropped the bottom 20 stories to the ground, the seismic signal would be just about what was recorded. And for the South Tower, the bottom 16 stories. It's not very, very tall.
And so basically what happened is there somewhere around ballpark 800,000 tons of porcelain, filing cabinets, chairs, steel, concrete, the contents of the building, and organic material turned to dust.
Everything that was there. And there were no recognizable toilets or parts of toilets in any of the rubble, or desks and chairs.
Filing cabinets?
There was one filing cabinet. Well, I think that's what they thought it was. After they found the store owner, he told them that's what it was. It looked like a basketball. It was just this wadded-up thing. It still had colored dividers in it, and it still had money in it, dollar bills, $20 bills. And so they called up the owner, who was Ben and Jerry's ice cream store, and had him claim their money. It didn't burn up.
See, that's what's astounding is down here, which I've looked at all the different pictures. How many pictures, approximately, in evidence things have you looked at? Just a ballpark number?
Approximately 40,000, maybe more.
Yeah. As you see all of this stuff, and there is pictures of taken by different people of cars that look like they're on fire. We don't know if it is just because it looks like it is, which we'll get into that and you can explain that. But we have all this paper going around and nothing's burning of the paper. It's just absolutely astounding. Paper seems immune. What happened?
And then some of the firefighters were trying to put out car fires. Seems like that's what they're doing when they weren't doing anything else because there's so many of them. And they said initially the water had no effect on the car fires.
Yeah, hold that thought. We'll be back in a minute. Okay, well, we're back from break here, and I am very honored today to have Dr. Judy Wood and Andrew Johnson, two people in the whole world that probably know about 911 except the people that were the perpetrators. And Dr. Judy Wood has written a book Where Did the Towers Go? .com. And that book is available at www.wheredidthetowersgo.com, all one word. And it's the only comprehensive forensic investigation out there in the public forum. I don't know what to say. It's shocking when you see these things. And then I also have Andrew Johnson in, and he has a web page, www.checktheevidence.com. And he's written a book also that's complimentary, 911 Finding the Truth, which actually you can even download for free. I have two people on that really know a lot about what happened in 911. Go ahead, Dr. Judy Wood or Andrew.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I think, you know, as you've been pointing out, Ralph, what you've got to do is keep looking at the evidence. And, you know, I've been sort of saying more recently that what Dr. Judy Wood has done, she's essentially reverse engineered how the towers were destroyed and what happened. You know, she started with what happened and then essentially reverse engineered the type of technology that was used, which we'll probably come to later. And, you know, my process of discovery was kind of, I don't know, 4 or 5 years behind Dr. Judy Wood, so it took me about 5 years to catch up with her. And then I wrote this book, I didn't really write it like that. It was actually developed over about 3 years, a set of articles that needed to be written to document what was going on. So in what I will tell people, and I think my book essentially is a reverse engineering of the cover-up of the research, and I suppose it touches on things like people's psychology and how, you know, certain types of human psychology can be used to manipulate other types of human psychology. Although I don't put it in those terms, you will see that really in a practical sense. And so in my own way, I feel I've collected evidence. I don't think I've looked at 40,000 pictures, but I've probably looked at 40,000 emails, so something like that. And quite a lot of them mention thermite as well, but, well, you know.
But why was it only 1 week's worth of emails?
Well, something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's probably still worthwhile going through some of the evidence that we haven't covered yet. I know some people will have heard this before, but perhaps there are some people that are new to it, and therefore it is worthwhile checking out Dr. Judy Wood's book, or, you know, you can look at the website, drjudywood.com, where you'll see most of the pictures, many of the pictures, and I think, you know, Dr. Wood has said that that's sort of like an online filing cabinet, which is a very good way of describing it. Things are categorized, and you'll see all this evidence sort of broken up into a number of series of web pages, which you can sort of follow through. But the book will then take that evidence and, you know, package it into a sort of tutorial, really, I suppose, and a very good one, very, very good one, because, you know, basically, if you're a layperson, you'll be able to follow it. And if you have a more detailed knowledge of engineering or scientific discipline, you will also get more out of it, because there are calculations in there, there are graphs, there are tables, which some people are put off by. And, you know, we heard from somebody this week where they got the book and they said, well, I'm thinking of returning this book because it looks a bit too much like a textbook. And then a couple of hours later, or maybe the next day, the person said, oh, actually, I've actually opened the book now and started to look through it more carefully, and I want to keep it now because it's very readable. So, again, you know, this person was seemingly judging the book by the cover or the first few pages. But I think, you know, I think Dr. Judy Wood can now continue with some of the evidence that we haven't yet covered.
Well, thanks, Andrew.
Some of the things that, to me, that was, and you can get them when you want to, is the non-self-quenching part of this. I thought that was an astounding, interesting thing that you discovered there. This bathtub, I think, is something that needs to be explored, too, is why, how did that thing survive? I mean, they were so scared of when Irene came up that they got around and shut down all the subways, because they know how vulnerable New York is to any rise in water.
And another interesting person who ordered a book lives in Vermont, a college professor in Vermont, ordered a book like last week, the week before, got it and was reading it just coincidentally when this Hurricane Irene was coming up the coast, aimed for New York, and saw this panic about shutting things down. And just when the hurricane was getting there, they reached Chapter 18. The first picture on the cover page of Chapter 18 is this big Hurricane Erin, which was had more cyclonic energy than Hurricane Katrina. It was a Category 3 and was aimed directly towards New York with no landmass in between. You know, Irene was bumpity-bump up the coast. It was just barely a Category 1 and really wasn't going to build up more than that. Yeah, it had rain associated with it, but it wasn't going to, you know, blow things over or really tear things up terribly. But it was all this warning and panic over that, but really not much at all about Hurricane Erin. It's just puzzling because Manhattan is at sea level, the subways are below, and if you have a hurricane station right outside of town for very long, you're going to have storm surges and massive flooding. And it's hard to evacuate Manhattan that quickly.
And there wasn't any panic. There wasn't any, basically, any knowledge on any of the stations or anything. It's just it headed up towards that area and parked itself outside of New York City, and nobody wants to talk about it?
10 minutes to 15 minutes before the North Tower got its hole, the first event of the day on 9/11, the morning weather maps didn't, they showed that part of the ocean, but they didn't show the hurricane there. You know, the graphical map, not the photo. They didn't show a photo map of it.
That's pretty hard to miss by the Category 3 hurricane, isn't it, you think?
Yeah. And even, you know, before flights take off, the pilot and the crew, you know, talk about anything that they need to talk about at the pre-flight meeting. And there's an airline attendant that contacted me saying when he saw Hurricane Erin on my website, that was the first time he learned about that. And he had flown out of Boston that morning. Didn't realize why they banked, you know, went west. Didn't know there was a hurricane right there.
That's pretty astounding, isn't it?
It's quite surprising.
I mean, how do you miss that? You know, I mean, you just got to say there's got to be a controlled effort to suppress that, because if you look in your book, that thing got on a magnetic line and it was headed right up towards New York area.
It was the really odd path. I couldn't find any other hurricane for like the past 100 years that is aimed directly perpendicular to the shore. Usually they swoop around and go up the coast, not heading directly towards New York.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite peculiar. It's interesting coincidences.
And so what happened? 911 happened, and what did Erin do, and what happened then?
It turned around that afternoon and headed out of town again. There was a high-pressure system moving from the Midwest eastward at the same time Erin was moving from the east to the west, and they met right over, the two systems met right over Manhattan at 10 a.m. on 9/11. Why I say 10 a.m. is you could see the high-pressure system moving in as the pressure increased, and then abruptly the pressure starts decreasing, which is the effect of the hurricane. And the weather changed, I think, you know, the night before the humidity level, relative humidity was 100%, and it was like 80% that morning. But from between morning and noontime, it went down linearly to 40%, from 80% to 40%, just a straight line. The weather was changing. But during that time period, the hurricane stayed the same speed, kept the same pressure, at approximately the same location for about 24 hours surrounding the events of 9/11. If nothing else, it provided a controlled environment that was quite constant.
Well, I find it absolutely astounding that Irene, they get all hyped up about, and they got something that's extremely more dangerous, very close. And not a peak, nothing, no warnings or anything in New York.
If they think it's going to turn around, you know, well, they thought it was going to turn around the first day, and then it went to the second day, and maybe it's going to turn around the next day, and, you know, for 4 days straight. Mm-hmm. But what they tell people, well, it's voluntary to evacuate before it becomes mandatory, just in case. They give people a head start. Mm-hmm. And, if the thing had stayed there any longer or if moved any closer, there wouldn't have been time to evacuate.
And then as soon as 911's over, it hangs a right and goes out and dissipates.
Yep. And there's rain, like it dumped 2 inches of rain on the backside as it headed out.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about the all of this dust? This dust came down, and then all of a sudden the dust is going back up, and we're seeing dust from satellite photographs, and we're seeing, that it doesn't keep, once you do this non-self-cleansing. Why don't you address that?
It was strange that it kept fuming up, and they said fires for 99 days, but there really wasn't any fire, because when you put water on fire, you get more stuff in the air, more smoke, steam, stuff comes up in the air when you're putting out a fire. The days that, especially when Hurricane Aaron was moving out of town, it dumped 2 inches of rain on the debris field, and it took the dust out of the air. And then as soon as it dries out, the dust starts rising again. they kept sprinkling it down. They brought in loads of dirt, dumped the dirt down, sprinkled it with mist, with water, and then scooped it up, took it out, brought in more dirt, wet that down, and this continued on for weeks and weeks and months and years. And you kind of wonder, is something continuing to degrade? The building across the street from Tower 2, just on the south side of Liberty Street, Bankers Trust, or the Deutsche Bank, had this gash in the front with wheat checks hanging in it. The wheat checks, wasn't really even scratched up. It didn't carve out that big hole in the building, but it had this big void in the front of the building. In the next year, they repaired it. And after they finished the repairs, then they started taking the building apart. Deconstruction begins after repairs are complete. So they're repairing a building to take it apart, and they started taking it apart bit by bit. When they got down to the level, approximate level where that hole was in the front, that big gash was, the columns and beams were just rusted severely as though they'd been at the bottom of the ocean for 100 years. Very deteriorated. It was puzzling. And they're very slow, and just this past February, they finally got down to the ground level for Bankers Trust. I was there last week, and, they're now down into the hole. And they, again, won't let you look in. They have the fences around, but they have a sheet covering the fence, so you can't look in. I went over there, and the guard comes after you, chases you off, won't let you look in. So it's kind of curious. But the rest of the complex, so it was puzzling. Like, how can they build on this land? Well, they turned the footprint of Tower 1 and Tower 2 into a memorial. And I think they're talking about putting the front area where the gash had been in the building, they're turning that into a memorial area and having a building further back. So what about the other, though? It's like over where Building 4 was and where Building 6 was, there's big buildings going up. What was very striking is that they reminded me of oil rigs. Oil rigs are up on big stilts. The building part of the oil rig is up high on stilts. That's what these look like. And the bottoms of the buildings are like encased in concrete. You don't build skyscrapers out of concrete. Mm-hmm. You build them out of steel because steel is stronger per weight. Otherwise, you end up with too much weight, not enough strength. So it's not really a strong thing to use. But let's think about how they dispose of nuclear waste. Don't they build a big concrete vat and put it in there and bury it?
Yeah.
So what about burying the steel columns that hold the building up to protect them from environmental degradation?
I think it's worth mentioning that we were talking about some kind of nuclear effect, and that doesn't necessarily mean from a nuclear bomb or an underground nuke or a micro nuke or neutron bomb. It doesn't necessarily mean that, because as we've mentioned on this program a couple of times before, the evidence suggests it's a different type of nuclear effect. It's sort of like a it's not a sort of chain reaction in terms of an expanding chain reaction or anything like that. It appears to be a low level degradation, and it doesn't give off a lot of traditional type of radiation. And it seems to have some relationship to cold fusion, which is also generates nuclear effects with low energy. It's actually, that's the other name for cold fusion, is low energy nuclear reactions. And this is all about actually low energy, at least in terms of the ambient energy creating heat or things like that. So, all this evidence, and also I think going back to the talk about the hurricane, I bring that up a lot when I speak about this, and people do have a very great difficulty. They don't have difficulty, seeing the path and seeing it's extremely unusual, and they do pretty much agree that this hurricane must have been manipulated in some way. Difficult though that is to take in if you've not been studying this sort of research for the last few years as we have. So I think it's worth trying to bring in why the hurricane was there. Well, not necessarily why, but what the effect of the hurricane being there was, because that was also measured in New York City. And I don't think you mentioned that in the bit of the discussion that you'd made so far.
Well, in looking into what hurricanes do, first of all, it was unusual there. So then I start thinking about what do hurricanes do? What could it have been used for? And not that we know that that's what it was used for, but what do hurricanes do? What benefits would there be of having a hurricane there? They change the environmental electrical energy. Birds, when a hurricane's coming, they know to leave town. They can sense it coming. And often you hear people with arthritis talk about feeling the weather change, feel the weather coming. There's electrical energy ahead of the storm.
Hold that thought. We're going to break. Okay, we're back for a break here, and continue on with your thought. Andrew?
We were just talking about the hurricane and why that was,
Oh, that's important. Right, and the static field in front of the hurricane, and that's how birds know to head for the hills or head for cover.
Right,
we're
talking about an electrical phenomenon. When we say a static field, that means that an electrical field, an influence of electricity, which doesn't sort of alternate like it does within a wire. It's just kind of a presence. It's that type of feel which makes your the hairs on your arms stand up, or that sort of thing,
or that arc when you drag your feet across the carpet in the winter and reach for the door handle, it arcs across.
That sort of field is what a hurricane what is part and parcel of a hurricane. That sort of field is always there, because that's what partly drives the hurricane into being what it is.
And 9/11, was the hurricane close enough to have that kind of field affecting that area? Well, we go to the airports, the LaGuardia Airport, JFK Airport, and Newark Airport. All three surrounding major airports reported thunder on 9/11. So it's like reaching your hand over towards the doorknob and having the spark arc over.
And yet nobody wants to talk about it or report it.
Right. And, it's been my experience that if you look around the internet and you look into things like weather modification, hurricane manipulation, and this sort of thing, there are a number of people that come up and speak about these topics and have spoken about these topics. Two people that I can mention that you can go and check is Jim McCanney, who has a science hour that he does, I think, we used to do that every week. And another person that I came across in 2005, I think, talking about hurricane, it was Katrina, but Hurricane Ophelia, I think he had a plot of that. And this was Richard Hoagland on his blog. yet these two people who are very prominent and make a lot of appearances on alternative talk shows have either not bothered to talk about the connection between 9/11 and Hurricane Erin, or if they have you know, got it basically hopelessly wrong. So, I think the very importance of this, you know, this to me, I don't know whether Dr. Judy would agree with me at this point, but I think this is probably the, you know, almost the most important evidence, because it then kicks into touch this idea of, you know, global warming and climate change as being some result of burning fossil fuels. And in fact, these two coupled together are a complete, you know, the double dip disinfo, as I call it, the fossil fuel scam and the climate change scam are connected with one another now in the public consciousness. And yet, with the research that's in Where Did the Towers Go, you essentially come to the point that you can see that both of these are interlinked scams, because, you know, I take the conclusion that if somebody can steer a hurricane, then they can affect the weather. And also, from the technology that was used, it basically liberates energy from within the environment somehow, or from within the material. I mean, I personally am not sure exactly which it is. But this then also means that this technology is understood sufficiently to weaponize it, which means that it hasn't been released in a form which we can use for a power system.
Powering our house and our vehicles or whatever.
Exactly. So, you know, I think if you really just try and get to grips with this when you're studying this, you'll then realize why this cover-up has been so very, very powerful and so comprehensive, and why it actually is like that.
I hear the music. We'll be back for next hour. Stay tuned. We've got more information. We're not even close to getting through all the evidence yet. Okay. Ralph Winterroad Show, coming to you live out of Alaska. That's I like that song. It was in Top Gun, Take My Breath Away by Berlin. And I'm really honored today to have Dr. Judy Wood, that has the only comprehensive forensic investigation in the public forum, the only one. And she's on as my guest today, and I'm also glad to have Andrew Johnson out of the UK. He's been in this battle for quite a few years, too. And we're going to have Keith here. He has a short comment he's been holding for a while from Indiana. You have a comment here you want to make on the air, Keith?
Yes. I just want to thank Dr. Judy Wood and Andrew and you, Ralph, for having this show. I was sad to hear Capitol Forum on RBN this morning where they completely dished. You know, they went on 2 hours about why you're a quack and a kook. But, you know, I thought this might help, because sometimes scientists like Dr. Judy Wood and the communication, but for lay people like me, start with planes. If there's no credible evidence for any planes at Shanksville or Pentagon or World Trade Center, and no bodies, no body parts, that means there's no planes. That's simple. Dr. Judy Wood did a very good job. Thermonuclear, so boom, there's no sound. They can't explain it with bombs, plus the bathtub. The water would rush in, the heat would be there, there would be a steam. Is that right, Dr. Judy Wood? There'd be a steam explosion had there been a nuclear?
Yes. Yeah, the nuclear explosion would break the bathtub and produce heat. Heat with water, steam explosion.
Right. And then you've got the seismic evidence, which isn't there, which would have to be there with bombs, too. And then we get into this thermite, and they go on and on this morning about, oh, yeah, they found evidence for thermite, but isn't iron and aluminum part of the makeup of thermite?
Yes, and the building turned to dust in midair, and the building, that's the ingredients of the building.
Exactly. So that doesn't prove it's thermite, because it's the ingredients of the building, too. These people are calling in. They're out of their minds. They think they're walking through hot, molten metal, but their feet aren't burning, like you said. Feet burn when you're going, you know, paper burns. You know, I mean, you've done an excellent job by following the evidence, but what people want is a carnally minded that, you know, are just generally not known to the public. I mean, they're not in their consciousness.
But right? It's interesting. They require the serial number for the gizmo that I'm talking about, but they don't require a serial number for the thermite or for the bombs.
Yes. And the whole thing, too, about roping off crime scenes at Shanksville, about videos in the airport, about the fact the airport security is all run by Israeli companies. In fact, the only thing that I would kind of differ with you a little bit is you're an expert in how it happened, but I think who did it is important, too.
Oh, I think it's important, too. I've done more to pursue that than anyone has. Who did it? And I filed a court case against them.
Yes, you did, and Richard Gage did not, and they filed a 501c3, and every time they bring it up in their complaint, they don't talk about molten metal, and they don't talk about thermite. Isn't that right?
Yep. Okay, well, thanks, Keith.
One last thing, Ralph. I did a search.
Do you want to hold over the break? We got to go to break.
All right.
Got to go to break. Back in a minute. Okay, we're back for a break here, and Keith, you had a final point you wanted to make here before we move on?
I tried to do a search on Richard Gage, and you put in, it's Richard. I got 300 websites that came up with nothing but praise for Richard Gage, except a few that said the official story's right, the plane, not thermite.
Sure.
This guy is heavily connected.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And
if you don't get together with Statmiller, the host of RBN, and say, why are you putting out all this contradictory information? Because go back and listen to Capital Foreman. That was an abomination. If Richard Gage, not a high-level person, and I'm a shapeshifter.
Every host can put on what they want to say here, I don't have any control over that. I don't know. You're going to have conflicting views here. So, anyway, I want to thank you for calling here. I got another caller, but I want to have Dr. Judy Wood get back to an extremely important issue on the whodunit, and somehow because she has focused initially on the foundation of what happened and how it happened, could you address the rest of, do you care who done it, Dr. Judy Wood?
I've done more about pursuing that than anyone has. You can't just speculate on who did it and go do a witch hunt. In order to convict someone of a crime, you need to first determine what crime you're going to arrest them for. And then you provide the evidence that they committed that crime. Talking about the Casey Anthony trial, they couldn't convict the gal for it because they didn't know how the child died. They don't know what the crime was, in other words. They don't know how the child died. So you first have to determine what happened before you can determine how it happened, before you can determine who did it. And what I have done is determine what happened and how it happened. And who knows who did it? Those who helped NIST with their report are experts in this area. They know what they're looking at. They have a contract with the U.S. government. They have had for quite a few years to know everything about any weapon of mass destruction. Their area of expertise is energy weapons. So they not only know what type of weapon it is, but they know whose weapon it is. And I took them to court.
That's Applied Research Associates.
Yes, Applied Research Associates. They develop and manufacture energy weapons. They're a founding sponsor.
I think it's an interesting name as well, Applied Research Associates. I mean, what does that mean? It's a very innocuous kind of name, and we have some government departments like that as well. I think agencies that the miscellaneous services agency. I know it's not called that, but there was another one that we came across. I think
something
on the website.
That.
And
also Science Applications International Corporation.
Right, that of course doesn't do anything because it's just looking at science, in an international sense. It's not really doing anything particularly interesting. So we choose a very innocuous name, that won't attract attention to anything. We don't call it the Secret Weapons Development Agency, or something like that.
But you actually took those two companies to court in a Keaton case, a whistleblower case, and said, come on down, we need to get the discovery, didn't you?
Right, 23 defendants in the case. And to hold them accountable, I'm the only one who has gone to the trouble of actually going after someone for the you know, cover up of what happened to the buildings.
Mm-hmm. I think also I'd just like to say that, you know, several people have called in on some of these programs to talk about things like the Freemasons and the Zionists, and, you know, that's something I will mention from time to time, because I've done bits of research into those organizations. But the way I kind of view it is, you know, they're a bit like the Mafia in terms of, we know that those groups do criminal activities and are involved in secret networks, secret deals, and all of this. But the way that they have infiltrated the system means that you're going to have a real hard time proving anything that they've done, and directly linking this to, you know, this act is very, very difficult. So difficult, in fact, that you know, you're never really going to progress with that as things stand at the moment. Maybe in future we'll get more whistleblowers coming forward or something, but in the past, you know, they've often come to grief. So, you know, and there's so much disinformation about that as well. You know, that you really are having a lot of trouble to pin particular parts of the crime on particular groups. And certainly, well, I would agree.
If it's a secret group that people are members of that organize this, but if it's a secret group, you don't see them meeting secretly. But in their day jobs, that's where they take action. So it's making that connection is hard.
Right. And I mean, you know, going back to the companies, proving that certain members of say, you know, SAIC or ARA or other companies are Freemasons. It's you know, and then proving that as a Freemason they've been involved in a secret deal which has resulted in aspects of 9/11 being done a certain way. You know, it's virtually impossible to do that as things stand at the moment. And I know that people kind of want blood and they want to blame it on somebody, but we're really not in a position, as I see things. You know, I think we would probably both agree, we wish we were. We would like to see these people held accountable before a jury for what they've done, and to get the truth out. But, you know, and Dr. Judy Wood's case has brought us closest to that, but hardly anybody knows about it because those same secret networks have
covered it up. You
know, yeah, covered it up.
If Richard Gage wants to see somebody put under oath, why didn't he support this case?
Right.
This case had, it had virtually no support, and if it had support, it would have been a lot harder for those judges to sweep it under the carpet.
And, you know, I'd just like to bring in a couple of things there, because Richard Gage, his group, never even submitted the thermite evidence to their, you know, legal case, which never got to that point because they didn't even put it in the RFC. And I've been showing people this, you know, and they're frankly quite shocked that they didn't even put thermite in the basis of their legal challenge, which would have been the RFC. It's not even in there. So he's not even prepared to go under oath with the evidence that he talks about week in, week out, radio show in, radio show out. He's not even prepared to put that on a legal cutting anyway. And added to that, you know, we haven't got to the Hutchison effect yet, which is what, you know, the evidence points to, that something
proof
like
of concept.
Exactly. Something like the Hutchison effect is very important in what happened. And, you know, people go on, oh, John Hutchison's done this, John Hutchison's done that, and, you know, all these videos can be faked, and he's faked them, and all this nonsense. But what they're never told, and they never seem to bring up themselves, is that John Hutchison submitted an affidavit in the very court case we've been talking about. And his affidavit ran to 30 pages, and you can read it. And within that affidavit, we have a letter from Canadian MP Chuck Cook, which says that John Hutchison's research was classified as a matter of national security. And then we have the Colonel John Alexander, who visited John Hutchison in 1983. Who does Colonel John Alexander work for? Or has worked for, I should say, Los Alamos Laboratories.
Energy weapons.
And who's Steve Nee Jones worked for? Who's, you know, with the main proponent of this thermite theory or scam, whatever you want to call it. I think I prefer the latter term now. Who has he worked for? Los Alamos National Laboratories. So, you know, you put those things together, and although you can't say directly, you know, who did it, you can look to the areas where those people are going to have their, you know, key influences. And then, you know, you listen to what Eisenhower said in 50 years ago, And he said, you know, look at the military-industrial complex. You know, and this revolving door between government and industry. I mean, I have a little thing in the presentation that I give about Dr. Judy Wood's research in terms of the backdrop to it, really, and the cover-up. And I've got this little clip of Norman Mineta, you know, and he has this clip with Lee Hamilton where he's saying, you know, he's in this bunker with Cheney, and Cheney refuses this shoot-down order. It's a very peculiar little bit of testimony that have people up in arms, a bit like the Larry Silverstein thing. They're saying, oh, he was saying Cheney is, you know, refused the shoot-down order. Cheney knew the plane was going to hit the Pentagon, even though it didn't. And then you find out that Norman Mineta, who's the only official carried over between the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, he was a former vice president of Lockheed Martin, you know, which is one of the biggest defense contractors who make directed energy weapons. So, you know, if people look at these connections, I mean, I found out myself in about 5 minutes, you know, and if people are not going to look for these things, then they ain't going to find the truth, and they're not going to find the perpetrators. And, in fact, all this thermite nonsense, you know, is a complete blind alley to lead you away from the perpetrators, because it's been set up by the perpetrators to do just that. And that's the way it is.
Well, I find it astounding, too. I listen to Richard Gage and these other guys. We need a new investigation. God, it's just over and over. And then they want to discredit NIST. Let me read from a letter here. NIST. This is a letter that Dr. Judy Wood got. And by the way, it's in the NIST report in the footnotes if you read it. You have a letter. I'm looking at a letter.
Hang on. It's in the footnotes, but it could be possibly ambiguous, and I wanted it clarified, and they clarified it nicely.
I'm going to read here. So, July 27, 2007. It's to Dr. Judy Wood, and I'm quoting, NIST only investigated the factors leading to the initiation of the collapses of the WTC towers, not the collapses themselves, end quote. Back in a minute, I want to hear a comment on that. Why would we talk about a NIST report when they didn't even investigate anything? Back in a minute. Okay, we're coming back on the air here. And first of all, I want to finish addressing the issue. We got a couple of questions here from callers' comments. But Dr. Judy Wood, would you continue on addressing the why would we talk about the NIST report when I just read here it said the NIST only investigated the factors leading to the initiation of the collapses of the WTC towers, not the collapses themselves? So from my perspective, which I do legal research, it's a non-issue. The NIST report is a piece of junk. So why would you go to try to discredit it when they didn't even investigate it?
That was in response to my statement that their analysis violated the laws of physics, violated the conservation of energy and conservation of motion, momentum. And they said, no, it didn't, because the building, essentially, they're saying that the building was standing as long as it was standing. So it couldn't be violating the laws of physics because it was still standing. And they are not responsible for that moment on when the buildings quit standing. So right there, it's like, they're not giving an analysis. They don't have to be accountable for the analysis.
Which means their analysis is junk. So why would you want to discredit something when they say we didn't really investigate it?
It didn't happen.
Yeah, so why? It's just illogical. Why would you spend any time when they already have admitted there's no real analysis from after the moment the buildings were standing when the first little pebble fell?
They gave a hypothetical scenario. Had nothing to do with what really happened.
So that means it's junk. And then the other people that were on the committees have discredited it, too. So why would you spend any time, like in the international hearing in Toronto, wanting to talk about a report that they said we didn't really investigate it? We just made up a hypothetical what if, and who the hell cares?
I like what Thomas Potter has been posting around on various places on the Internet. If you want to know what happened on 9/11, you want an investigation, costs you $39.95 plus shipping. If you want a cover up, it costs you $200 plus airfare there and lodging.
Yeah, to go to a bunch of people. I looked at all of their people. We got politicians, we got psychologists, we got theologists, We got a couple of chemists there. Niels Herod is one, and he said it might be energetic thermite or thermite, nanothermite, might be energetic or even explosive. That I read in an affidavit in the Gallup appeals thing. A couple of other chemists, and that's it. You have more qualifications than the whole lot put together, and you weren't invited.
No, they don't want to know what happened. Look over here. Don't look there. Look over here. Look at this distraction.
And I got it from talking to Gorley. I talked to both of the sponsors. And what they were doing is assembling a bunch of people to use their name to give credibility to a whole bunch of nonsense by a whole bunch of people. We have a hearing for a bunch of dentists, but we don't invite the dentists. We have a hearing for relativity, but we don't invite the physicists. We invite politicians and theologians and psychologists and give me a break. It's shocking. And like you say, that $200, and if you want a bunch of nonsense, that would be the way to go. Just some comments here, address quickly, and we also need to get into the Hutchinson effect and some other things, which is really important. A couple of callers have put in wondering about the airplanes, where the passengers were or not. Could an airplane cut into the buildings like butter, which seems beyond belief? And there's the gold belt, and why didn't it flow to the bottom of the basement? Where's all the molten metal?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people bring up the planes, and I think, they think that if you avoid that issue, you're covering something up. And essentially, when the building turns to dust, the plane issue kind of doesn't have any bearing on that part of the investigation, if you see what I mean.
Except there's something to argue about and to get distracted about, go round.
Exactly. But whether these planes actually struck the towers or they didn't, in either case, the rest of the steel structure wouldn't have turned to dust as it did. So when you get into the plane stories, it is a distraction. However, you know, that the issue with the planes, I've looked at that quite extensively, and I did this witness study, which I've probably spoken about before. And to summarize what I know about the plane issues is that the physical damage caused to the face of the World Trade Center could not have been caused by a Boeing jet. And Dr. Wood's book covers that, I think, in the first few pages, looking at the issue of the plane-shaped holes and that sort of thing. But that's not the central part of the investigation. But looking at things like where did the passengers go, well, you know, I have a bit in the presentation that I give where I try to sort of give my conclusion about the plane story. And essentially, I think that because of the military exercises that were going on that day, they were able to inject some stories about hijacked planes into the system, and then that was also fed out to the media at the appropriate points. What the witnesses saw in New York City, you read the witness accounts, and they actually conflict quite considerably when you study the first responders' accounts. Some say they saw planes, some didn't. Some of the videos have sort of conflicting appearances in them. Some of the photographs apparently claim to be from different cameras, but they're actually the same picture.
Oh,
you superimpose them.
Hold on,
so there's all kinds of anomalies with the plane stories, which I've looked into. And, you know, basically, as I see things, there are no large pieces of plane found at any of the crash sites.
Okay,
no serial
numbers.
Hold
that. Andrew, we're going to break here. We'll be back. Okay, we're back from break here. And Andrew, you want to finish up on the airplanes? And then we're going to take Randall, a question from him, and then we're going to get into Hutchinson effect. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, so just to look at the plane issue, I mean, the plane's story is very peculiar when you look into it. I recommend that people go and look up the original, or rather the second Loose Change film, because there's a 15-minute segment in that where they talk about, for example, two of the planes weren't listed to fly that day, and two of the flights may have landed at Cleveland Airport, and there's a whole new story about that. So that may have been these decoy planes, which were sort of, exchanged for the real planes, at least on the radar screens of these operators. And this sort of thing. So it is very, very peculiar. And as I say, there were no registered plane parts found with serial numbers. None were fully identified. And then two of the planes weren't deregistered. till about 2 or 3 years after the events, and so they're normally deregistered within 24 hours after an air accident. So, and things like the cell phone calls couldn't have worked because of the handoff problem. So really, you know, that to me calls the plane story sufficiently into doubt. And as I said initially, it's kind of irrelevant to what Dr. Wood's been discussing with what happened to the buildings anyway, which is vitally important to understand.
Right, because there were 7 buildings came down and 2 airplanes. So how did the other 5 buildings get involved with no airplanes?
But also, you know, airplanes can't turn buildings into dust, whether they're real or fake. You know, fake airplanes can't do it either.
Right.
So it doesn't matter.
Okay, Randall, your turn up. You got a question for Dr. Judy Wood, and then we want to get into Hutchison defect. You got a question? Being patient for listening. Randall, are you there? Hello, Randall. Randall, are you there?
Who's there now?
Hello?
Yeah, Randall, are you there? You got a question for Dr. Judy Wood or Andrew or both?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, for some reason it couldn't come through. I've got 2 questions, and one's going to be on the Hutchison effect, and the other one is, the first one's going to be about, I heard Dr. Wood talking in an interview this week, and she questioned whether, you know, we have to question everything about this whole event, right? And she questioned, did $2.3 trillion go missing? And so we had Cynthia McKinney interviewing Donald Rumsfeld in front of a congressional commission on September 10th. And so, you know, and now we've got Cynthia McKinney up in Toronto at this phony truth commission. So I don't know about anybody else, but my antennas went, you know, full modulation when I saw her up there with that phony event.
What's your second question?
Okay, so my first question is going to relate to if the $2.3 trillion may not have gone missing, then why would the Project for a New American Century kind of implicate themselves 2 years in advance or more about a new Pearl Harbor? You know, what would be the point of that? And then the second question is, I live in Arkansas, and I was here when the bird kills happened and the fish kills happened. And so the bird kills, the forensic analysis, was stated that, it was from blunt force trauma in midair. Okay. And it was one species of bird. And then the fish that got killed, that was one species of fish that got killed. Well, there's more than one species of bird in the air, and there's more than one species of fish in the river. And so, What I noticed, a sort of a strange phenomenon, and I can't remember which event it was, but I've got a wood stove, and the wood stove's got a vertically mounted fan underneath the firebox. And I just, maybe 6 months earlier, bought a new motor for that thing. And for some reason, during one of those events, the motor started vibrating. It started going, you know, and I thought,
let me interrupt you there. Let me address that, too, because we're running out of time here. We want to get to Hutchison. Thanks for your... Do you either one you want to address that, or we want to go into the Hutchison effect?
I forgot what the earlier statement was. I remember what it was. About the 2.3 or whatever. What I would like to ask in return is, you know, sort of a redundant kind of question. Do you think those who planned 9/11 just forgot to plan a cover-up?
No, but I'm just thinking about Cynthia McKinney, and like I had.
Right, there's all sorts of distractions, like, you know, the plane argument back with planes, no planes, even when that doesn't even matter what happened to the building. And same with the 2.3 million, it doesn't matter if it was or wasn't, it's a distraction like the planes that gets people looking away from what actually did happen.
Right.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. I want to get back to the Hutchison effect, but thanks for calling, Randall. Let's go ahead and get... But we're running out of time here to get Hutchison effect, which is really an important part of this whole thing.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. This is. I'll just summarize what it is. John Hutchison is a Canadian researcher who's been working since about 1979 to reproduce the experiments and the effects that Nikola Tesla documented in the sort of early 1900s and up until the sort of 1940s, basically. and Nikola Tesla, very, you know, sort of clever person, basically, to put it mildly, took the first X-ray photograph, probably made the first radio transmission before Marconi, developed the AC current system, which is used to transmit power down power lines. And so John Hutchinson started experimenting with some of the equipment as documented by Tesla's notes. And essentially what he was able to do over a period of time was develop a technique of what's called field interference, which involved using different types of field effect generators, such as Tesla coil, which will generate an electrostatic field, and various components which will generate magnetic fields, RF generators, in other words, radio frequency, microwave generators. And John explained to us that he uses up to 2 tons of equipment, maybe 50 different bits of equipment that he has to tune and tweak. And it seems he's creating some type of field interference, or that's what he is creating, by mixing together these energy fields in different ways. And then within this area where these fields are mixed together, and in fact not just within that area, sometimes it's a little bit, can expand out from the central area, apparently, from what people around him have seen happening, he can produce effects such as jellification of metal, which is right there with this idea of molten metal. But in John's case, he uses a very small amount of energy, input energy, up to only about 1.5 kilowatts, which is, you know, the amount required to boil a small kettle. He will then produce effects such as jellification. He produces weird fires where things sort of sparks and weird fires seem to get onto some of the samples occasionally. He produces levitation where things will lift off the ground, fly out of the sample area. He produces ongoing effects whereby changes in these materials, this jellification process, if you inspect this under a microscope or with you know, a scanning electron microscope or something like that, you can see that the crystalline structure in the materials that he's subjected to these energy interference effects, according to the Max Planck Institute, these samples keep on changing. And so you have about 7 or 8 different effects. The other one that he can do is he can make stainless steel rust. And I think, Dr. Judy would basically catalog these in the World Trade Center evidence. And so that, you know, that's my understanding of what the Hutchinson effect is. And I think Dr. Judy Wood could maybe sort of follow on from that.
As well as apparent transmutation as well, changing what appears to change elements or somehow shuffle them around. And the same thing was found at the World Trade Center. And the same thing is also found with low-energy nuclear reactions or cold fusion. And there's a lot of similarities with things. What I did was look at all of the evidence and just categorize all of the evidence at the World Trade Center. And I had done that before I found the work of John Hutchinson. And I just happened one day to be on the Internet looking around and found somebody's blog. And it was amazing. These were all the same phenomena. All of the phenomena that I found at the World Trade Center was in this work. And that was the blog of John Hutchinson. So I contacted him and went out to visit him and see what his equipment was like and see what it could do and evaluate the samples and whatnot. There were some other strange anomalies that John wasn't even aware of in his samples that I also saw in common with the World Trade Center. It's strange effects on materials, very strange. And so what we have here is a proof of concept of the phenomenon that, as Andrew Johnson has said, I've back engineered what caused it, and then we reproduced the same effects with this gizmo, this technology, you know, on a small scale, but it demonstrates that it can be done.
Right, and I think also certainly proof of concept was established, and I think from my own sort of standpoint, proof of cover-up was also established when I was in this scholars group on the steering committee with Jim Fetzer, and when Dr. Wood had made this connection with the Hutchinson effect, frankly, his reaction was not one of, oh, great, we found out, you know, the mechanism. It was, oh,
can I call the boss?
Yeah, yeah, I've got to do something here. And by the way, Andrew, you're taking all this for granted. And, you know, John Hutchinson's a fraud, in my opinion. So, you know, you're just childish for suggesting that, that we should be looking at this seriously. And so that's why I left the scholars group. And from that point forward, and this is heavily documented in the book that I wrote, you know, it went on to establish proof of cover-up, proof of PSYOP, proof of, let's look in the opposite direction. Let's just muddle this round with HAARP, and let's just muddle this up with, oh, it might be micro-nukes. Oh, no, it might be HAARP. Well, we'll just mix this all round.
Lasers, phasers, and plasmoids.
And plasmoids, yeah. It could be a plasmoid. I mean, yeah, what the heck is a plasmoid, Jim? Oh, it doesn't matter. It could be that, you know. So, you know, obviously I'm exaggerating to make a point there, but you know, you'll see that this to me is proof of cover up, and I urge people to look at it.
Yeah, I urge
people to look at
that
very carefully.
It, all this muddle up and juggling things around. Well, maybe it's this. Well, next week. Maybe it's this. Well, maybe it could be this. And round, just keep circling around until everyone says, I guess we'll never find out what really happened. Time to move on.
We never will. Yeah, that's
right. So quit looking. Don't open that book. Whatever you do, don't open Dr. Wood's book.
No, don't open it. Just, you know, you might get rabies or something from it, so, you know.
And don't go to websites. It's all speculation, no evidence.
No, that's right. Yeah, it's just, you know, you might as well not go there because there's no information there. There's no graphs. There's no pictures. There's actually just a blank page, you know, so there's nothing to see.
It's just a... Well, 540 pages of speculation.
Well, one of the things that gets me, you listen to all these, anybody that's after the truth will take and examine all of the evidence. You're the only one that's done that. You're the only one. Well, they want to nitpick one little teeny thing and built a whole bunch of baloney on one little item. Oh, we found the materials of thermite. So, therefore, back engineered all the rest of it. We're not going to talk about toasted cars. We're not going to talk about the magnetometer. We're not going to talk about seismic. Well, we don't even know anything about all that.
But thermite, what does thermite do? What's the relationship of what thermite is to what happened to the building?
Very good question.
Yeah. No relationship.
I don't think that any of the thermite promoters even know the relationship. I've got a quote from Niels Harrit, who wrote that thermite paper. He was a lead author on that thermite paper. And he said, is the quote, actually, within the group, the authors behind this paper, which we published in April, there are diverting opinions about what this nanothermite was used for. And in my opinion, we shouldn't speculate for the demolition.
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
It's kind of like making you think that it's not the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help you. You know, it's making you think that thermite was used to do something, because if you know, aluminum and iron are shown to be in the dust, and that is what is concluded in that article. If you go look at their, quote, peer-reviewed article, all they're doing is just saying that there's traces of aluminum powder and rusted iron powder. They're not saying anything about what those had anything to do with the towers.
I think also this whole mode of going around and asking for a new investigation, you know, essentially you're trying to encourage people to pay to, you know, to find, to look for the truth of what happened on 9/11, but not actually find it, which of course is how all the cancer charities operate now. You know, they pay all these groups to, you know, look for a cure for cancer, but they don't pay anyone to find one because it's already been found.
I'm holding in my lap right now a new the only investigation.
Right.
And going around saying we need a new investigation, what they are implicitly stating is that there isn't one out there.
Right.
They're implying that there isn't one out there when there is. And so that is the function of it. Now, they cannot lobby Congress because they're a 501c3, nonprofit, kind of like a church. They can't lobby Congress. So you know, what's the objective other than to just round and round and round?
Except also under the Smith-Mund Act, if these guys are PSYOPs, why isn't it they don't put their name down? Because if they go against another agency in a court case or something under their signature, that's treason.
If they work for a government agency and they submit fraudulent information to another government agency, that's attacking another government agency. That's doing PSYOPs, right? But if they aren't working for a government agency and don't, well, this is how I put it down to three things. The reason why they don't proceed forward, why their RFC that they submitted to NIST did not include any of their thermite evidence they talk about or molten metal. It's got to be one of three things. One, they didn't think it really was important to mention. It's nothing of significance. Number two, they know it's a federal crime to defraud the government. And number three, they know it's treason if they are working for a government agency doing PSYOPs in another government agency. So I can't think of any other choices other than those three things.
And then the next most obvious thing is, why doesn't anybody come out and buy your book and say, chapter one, this is the evidence here, and debunk it? Why don't they go, chapter two, and here's the evidence, debunk it? They don't want to talk about that, do they?
You can't debunk evidence.
Yep. Okay, we're going to break, and we'll come back. We've got a little over 3 minutes, and we'll be back for the closing from both of you. Thank you. Okay, we're back for break. I have Dr. Judy Wood. I'm very honored she took the time out today. The only comprehensive forensic investigation book out there, and a complimentary book has been written by Andrew Johnson out of the UK. And go for it, both of you. We got closing 3 minutes.
All of the issues about look here, look here, look over there, all these distractions about other things to look at, and well, maybe we'll never know what really happened, and maybe we need to call for an investigation. It's just all distraction. If you look at what happened, open your eyes and look at what happened, and in my book, I lead you through the evidence. It's just evidence, and looking at the evidence, you can see what happened right before our eyes, in front of the entire planet. What was demonstrated was a new technology. A technology that can provide free energy to the entire planet. If you see it and people acknowledge it is there, but it stays covered up by all this, look over here, look over there, we'll never know what happened, don't look, don't look. It's just this muddle-up scenario. But what is most important about this, once everyone realizes that this was free energy technology that was demonstrated that day, it's out in the open. People are free to develop it in broad daylight. Right now, people who develop it in their basement get suicided, you know, in secrecy. But this brings it out into the light of day. It allows free energy technology to be developed by anyone on the entire planet, but it changes the entire landscape of things. But what is most important of all that I'll end with is that we each must think for ourselves. How did we get here to begin with 9/11? It was following a PSYOPs, following a routine, taking on someone else's opinion as our own. Once we look at our own thoughts about a particular situation, to get rid of all the biases and look at it anew, that is our only way out of this.
Where do we get your book, Dr. Wood?
DrJudyWood.com or WhereDidTheTowersGo.com. That's hard to type. There's no spaces in there. Just WhereDidTheTowersGo.com.
Andrew, you got any comments, closing comments?
Yeah, I think, basically I'm 100% agreeing with Dr. Wood here on this. You have to think for yourself, look at the evidence. This whole psychological operation, you know, I don't know. It seems very difficult for some people to break free of it. And sometimes it seems that whatever we say falls on deaf ears. I mean, maybe that's just the way things have to be at this point in time. Yeah, it's very frustrating at times. But as I've said before, all the information you need is available. I encourage all researchers into alternative knowledge to engage with this evidence, study it. And
okay, I got to cut you off there. We got to go. I thank Dr. Judy Wood and Andrew Johnson for taking time today on the anniversary of 9/11. And we'll be back next Sunday. And as I always close out the show, watch out for the federales. They're everywhere. Stay safe. We will see you next Sunday.